Chapter 8. The moment he walked into the squad room, all activity came to a dead stop. He stood just inside the doorway for a moment, watching them, all watching him. Then he started to make his way across the room, heading back towards Hardesty's office. Hey, Steele, welcome back. Thanks, Carson! Carson had that same uneasy, searching look that Shelley Taylor had. He smiled awkwardly, then avoided Steele's gaze. Good to have you back, Steele. Thanks, Goldstein! Hesitant smile and anxious expression. Lieutenant? He turned. Bishop! He said with a nod. Young rookie was one of those he'd trained. He held out his hand and looked straight at him. Welcome back, sir, Bishop said. The sentiment was heartfelt. The eyes didn't slide away from his. The smile wasn't forced. Steele hesitated slightly, then took the outstretched hand. Thanks, kid! Bishop stared down at his hand for a moment. Is that... Yeah, said Steele. Nice steel alloy and polymer. Bishop glanced up at him and grinned. Geez, you could have fooled me. Feels just like real skin. They did one hell of a job. Steele smiled. Yeah, they did, didn't they? That broke the ice. They all came gathering around him, patting him on the back and shaking his hand, no longer quite so nervous, no longer walking on eggshells. Steele. He turned around. It was McCulkey. It got very quiet. McCulkey swallowed hard. Christ, Steele, I'm sorry. When I heard Mick scream, I nailed it. Only by the time we got there. It's okay, Dick, said Steele. You've got nothing to be sorry for. Those people were real pros. They hit hard and they hit fast. You couldn't have done anything. I just can't help the feeling that if I'd only been closer. It was my call, said Steele. Do you know anything about Mick? McCulkey said. He didn't make it. Yeah, he was a good man. McCulkey nodded. If you guys have questions... Then go ahead and ask him, Steele said. It's okay. I don't mind. For a moment, nobody spoke. Then Carson cleared his throat. What's it like? I mean, how does it feel? It'll take some getting used to, Steele said. I don't really feel any different. The prosthetics feel like they're my own parts. In a way, I guess they are. I've got a sensation in them, or what my new brain translates as sensations, and I'm a lot stronger now. He glanced down at one of the heavy wooden desks. For instance, I could take this desk and throw it across the room. I can turn up my hearing and hear your heartbeat. I can see in the dark. You mean your eyes are... Bionic optic units, Steele said. With laser designator, thermal imaging, and image intensifier systems built in. Wow, said Goldstein. And you can see normally through them? I mean, like you used to? Better than I used to, said Steele. For instance, I can see that blonde hair on your shoulder. Isn't your wife a brunette, Norm? Goldstein glanced at his shoulder. What? Where? Steele reached out and plucked a very fine blonde hair. Okay. Blonde hair off Goldstein's jacket. It was barely visible. That new records clerk is a blonde, isn't she? Said Steele. The others laughed and Goldstein blushed. And I can smell a trace of perfume, Steele said. But it's very faint. Your wife won't pick it up. Jesus, Steele. What the hell's going on out here? And nobody's got any work to do? The men moved aside, and Steele saw Hardesty standing at the doorway of his office. Oh, Steele, he said matter-of-factly. Captain, come on inside. The rest of you, get back to work. You can socialize when you're off duty.
Hardesty stood aside to let him in and shut the door behind him. He went around behind his desk and sat down. He gave Steele a long, appraising look.
You look good,
he said gruffly.
You look like hell, Jake.
Hardesty grunted.
Haven't been sleeping well, he said.
He hesitated and glanced down at his desk.
Dem Ulster's been acting up. I've been briefed about your man, Higgins, from the agency, he said. Arrogant son of a bitch.
Steele smiled faintly.
He is that. Understand, you're not under my command anymore, said Hardesty. Super cop only takes orders from the feds. Guess you finally got what you wanted. Not exactly, said Steele.
Hardesty grunted again. He looked up at him, and his expression softened somewhat.
You handling this okay, kid?
Yeah, a little shaky around the edges, but I'm all right. Thanks for asking.
Hardesty nodded, then grimaced, his hand clenched into a fist.
I never should have agreed to that damn meeting.
Forget about it, Jake. It's history.
Yeah, well, I just feel responsible, he sighed.
I guess it's gotta be a strange thing to get used to, having an artificial brain.
That's putting it mildly, said Steele. I don't really feel any different. I still think the same. Maybe it's not exactly thinking. Hell, I don't know. I keep wondering if anything weird is going to happen because of some glitch or something. I guess that's what this is all about. They sent me out to see if I'll work right.
Hardesty hesitated.
What happens if you don't?
They take me back in for an overhaul, I guess.
I heard Janice left you,
Hardesty said, looking down at his desk again.
Yeah, guess you couldn't take being married to a robot.
They tell me you're not.
Yeah, that's what they tell me too. Only I'm not sure I buy it. I'm a cyborg, part man, part machine. Only, how can you be a man with a computer for a brain?
Hardesty compressed his lips.
Look, I gotta ask you this, Steel. Go ahead.
Hardesty looked uncomfortable. He took a deep breath and let it out in a heavy sigh.
I'm sorry, but I don't know how else to put this. What happens if your brain goes on the fritz or something?
I don't know,
Steel said.
But they assured me that nothing can go wrong. Can go wrong. Can go wrong.
He tapped himself on the side of the head.
Sorry, it just loops every now and then. No big deal.
Hardesty stared at him, then snorted with mirth in spite of himself.
At least they left you with your sense of humor. But do me a favor and don't do that anymore, okay? It's spooky.
You should try it out from my end.
Seriously, Steel, what happens if something goes wrong?
I honestly don't know, Jake. That's why I'm going to stick by myself for a while. I don't want any partners. If anything does go wrong, I want to make sure nobody else is at risk.
Hardesty nodded.
Okay, it's your decision.
Yeah, and it saved you the trouble of assigning me a partner. I don't imagine anyone's anxious to be partnered with me.
Bishop and McCulkey both burnt in the request, said Hardesty. But I'll tell them it was my decision to have you work alone. There's one more thing. Far as I know, nothing's been released yet, but it won't be long before the media's on you like fox on a duck. How do you want to handle that?
Steel grimaced.
I don't,
he said.
Okay, no press conferences, no interviews. I'll take a statement to that effect when it comes time for that. I can put together something from Higgins told me, but you know I can't do anything to keep them off you when you're out there on your own.
I know. I'll just have to deal with that problem when it comes. I don't suppose I can avoid coverage, but I don't want to be a freak show. If Higgins calls you on it, tell him it was my decision.
Hardesty nodded.
You got it! Well, I guess that's about it, unless there's anything special you need that I should know about.
You mean like an AC adapter?
Hardesty snorted.
Go on, get out of here!
Steel smiled and turned to leave.
Steel!
He paused and turned around. Hardesty looked up at him and then down at his desk.
Look, for whatever it's worth, and it probably isn't much, I wish to God I hadn't sent you out on that contact. I just wish...
I know, Jake, Steel said. But I was the logical one to send. You did what you had to do. And I knew what I was getting into. There's no hard feelings.
Hardesty nodded.
Thanks,
he said.
Look, if you should need anything, I'll let you know, Jake. But right now, all I need is to draw some ordnance and get a chopper drop. Anything you need,
said Hardesty.
You went after Ice?
Ice was just a pawn, said Steel. Borodini's the one I want.
Hardesty exhaled heavily.
That's not going to be easy.
I know. But this time, I'm doing it my own way, Steel said. I'm going to rouse the gangs a little. Screw the regs. I got federal authority. If anyone upstairs starts screaming about me, refer them straight to Higgins.
Hardesty smiled.
It'll be my pleasure.
The scout attack police helicopter swooshed down low over the streets on the south side of Manhattan, descending over the area once known as Chinatown, the stomping grounds of the Green Dragons. The scat chopper was a fast and lightweight, sleek, multi-purpose rotary wing craft built on the Notar design, which meant it had no tail motor assembly. It resembled a miniature fighter jet with stubby wings and nose at both ends and a rotor assembly on top, just behind the cockpit. It boasted a carbon fiber frame and was equipped with a voice-actuated computer control systems, including infrared and electromagnetic sensing and tracking, air-to-air and air-to-ground missile packages, and machine gun turrets, all tied into the pilot's flight helmet. The cockpit was almost fully automated, including target acquisition and designation, visual displays, and map and area displays. His head completely hidden inside his VCASS helmet. VCAS? I don't know. The chopper pilot resembled some sort of a metallic insect from outer space. The visually coupled airborne systems simulator contained lens-like eyes that, instead of giving the pilot a normal human-sighted field of view, presented him with a computer graphic display and a grid reference. In the conventional sense, the pilot was blind. However, with the VCAS computer-generated imagery, he actually saw a great deal more than he could see with his naked eyes.
"Circle around the area several times," said Steele. Let's make ourselves conspicuous.
The pilot nodded, the motion seeming exaggerated in the bulky helmet. The chopper swung around, circling a 5-block area around Foley Square. After they had completed 3 circles, Steel went back to the side hatch and hooked the cable to his harness.
Okay,
he called out.
Take it down.
The chopper descended to about 100 feet, and Steele eased himself out of the hatch as he was slowly lowered down the cable. Anybody watching couldn't fail to see that there was only one man coming down, and Steele hoped it was a temptation that the dragons wouldn't be able to resist. His feet touched the ground, and he unhooked the cable. The chopper rose into the air, winching up the trailing cable, and Steele was left alone, but not unprotected. Slung across his shoulder, he carried a caseless 4.7mm polymer ceramic battle rifle, an updated design of the G11 rifle originally developed by the West German firm of Heckler & Koch near the close of the 20th century. In appearance, the rifle resembled nothing so much as a short black 2x4, slightly slimmed down towards the muzzle, with a pistol grip behind the trigger assembly and a small laser scope on top. The receiver was completely encased, rendering it impervious to dirt and debris. The trigger and magazine openings, as well as the small ejection port on the buttstock, were all sealed, rendering the rifle almost completely waterproof. The select fire system gave the rifleman the choice of semi-automatic fire, 3-round bursts, or full auto, and he had a choice of shotgun or rifle barrel. The long rectangular magazines were located along the top of the barrel and held 50 rounds. Using the 3-round burst capability, the weapon could fire 2,000 rounds per minute, with a 3-round burst being fired so quickly that it sounded like one shot. The caseless ammunition was completely consumed upon firing, so there were no shells to be ejected. Consequently, the only use for the small ejection port was to vent gas or clear the rifle around in the chamber. Because of its small size and efficiency, the high-velocity caseless round also allowed the rifleman to carry a significantly greater amount of ammunition, and Steele was loaded for bear. Strapped in an ankle holster, Steele carried a polymer ceramic 9mm semi-automatic pistol capable of firing encased or caseless ammunition. The polymer ceramic construction made it completely lightweight, non-recoiling, self-cleaning, and completely maintenance-free. The same technology was used in the design of the 40mm magazine-fed polymer ceramic handheld grenade launcher holstered on his belt rig. Only slightly smaller than a semi-automatic handgun, it was also capable of firing non-lethal polyurethane baton rounds that could deliver a powerful body blow up to 100 meters. Steele had also chosen to pack smoke-emitting canister rounds as well as the grenade rounds. On the other side of his belt rig, he carried a more conventional weapon, a large black alloy frame 44 Magnum, semi-automatic with a 6-inch barrel and a 10-shot clip. It was the proven, time-honored Israeli Desert Eagle design, the standard-issue sidearm of the Strike Force. His belt rig and shoulder harness carried spare magazine pouches for his weapons, and his shoulder holster held his personal sidearm, an antique that Steele had never relinquished, despite some joking harassment from his fellow Strike Force officers. It was a model 1911 A1 Colt 45. Government model, a semi-auto, a weapon dating back to the beginning of the last century. Primitive in comparison to the other weapons available to the modern police officer, but still no less effective. It had been his father's gun, the one with which he'd shot himself. It was the only thing of his father's steelhead left, and he wouldn't part with it for anything. He stood in the square near the ruins of the old criminal courts building, the New York City County Courthouse, and what had once been the headquarters of the NYPD at One Police Plaza. The buildings were all in ruins now, or standing empty in a sad state of disrepair. Their lower floors covered with gang graffiti. Steele walked slowly down Worth Street, heading east. He wore battle armor to cover his chest, back, and sides, but he had found that the riot helmet wasn't as efficient as his own optics, so he'd left it behind. His nice steel skull casing gave him considerable protection from a headshot, at least in theory. Down here, the city seemed deserted, but he knew it wasn't. The wretched poor of the city huddled inside these old ruined buildings, doing what they could to survive in no man's land under the domination of the street gangs that pretended to protect them. It was a protection racket that had its beginnings with organized crime in the city and still flourished today, more powerful than ever. The people here had no choice but to deal with the street gangs for their bare necessities of survival. They controlled the food supply. They controlled the streets. They controlled the ramshackle economy of no man's land. You worked for them at their pay. You bought from them at their price. You did business with them or you were out of business. The dragons had long since driven all competing gangs out of Chinatown. The only other power down on the south side were the Chingos, who controlled the area around the Bowery and Little Italy. For years, they had been at war. Now, Victor Borodini had brought them both under his umbrella, and together they controlled all of Lower Manhattan. Steele's arrival had not gone undetected. He had not gone more than 3 blocks before he was aware of all movement around him. He turned up his hearing. Just ahead and to his left, there were 6 of them, taking positions in the ruins of a collapsed building. There were more to his right. He counted 8, moving up through an alleyway, and more were closing in behind him. 10, 11, 12, and more coming. The sounds they made enabled his cybernetics to instantly compute their distance and position. It required no conscious thought on his part. He simply knew where they were, just as if he could see them. One man. They must have figured it was easy pickings. They were coming out in force. They wanted the weapons he was carrying, and they wanted blood. Steele stopped where he was in the middle of the street, an easy target. "Okay, boys," he said to himself softly. "It's party time." He could hear the telltale noises, inaudible to the normal human ear, of the gang members moving around and taking positions, the crunch of their boots on the concrete dust and gravel. He heard them unlimbering their weapons and resting them on the convenient supports, the scrape of metal and plastic against brick and concrete. He heard them talking to each other. What the hell's he doing here alone? Son of a bitch must be crazy. There's got to be support units around here somewhere. No, man, I saw the chopper coming in. He's the only one that came down. It's got to be fucking nuts. Yeah, well, I shoot his fucking nuts right off. What's he doing? He's just standing there. That doesn't make no sense. Why the hell would he come down here alone? Who knows? Soft chuckle. Maybe he's trying to commit suicide. Hell with him. Let's take him out. Sound of bolts being drawn back. Steel broke into a run a fraction of a second before they opened fire. Bullets whistled through the air where he had once stood, bracketing his position. But he was no longer there. He was moving fast, faster than any normal man could move, sprinting for the cover of the buildings to his left. As he ran, he unholstered his handheld pistol-shaped grenade launcher, only slightly larger than a .44 Magnum revolver, but only a fraction of the weight. The magazine he had loaded held staggered rounds, grenade rounds alternating with smoke canister rounds in pairs. He snapped off two rapid shots as he ran, using his laser designator optics to sight in on their positions. His eyes glowed with two pinpoints of red light as two bright red glowing dots appeared in his field of vision directly over the position taken up by the gang members in the ruins across the streets. The launcher chuffed twice and the grenades struck right on target. He heard screams as explosions shook the ruined building, sending brick, concrete, and bodies flying up into the air. He didn't stop, but kept on moving, cutting through the abandoned building, kicking out a brick wall, and exiting out into the alley, circling back around the way that he came in. Hearing turned up all the way, he could easily hear every word they said, pinpointing their locations as they moved up behind him. Jesus, did you see that? Fucker's fast, man. Where the hell'd he go? Doesn't matter, son of a bitch ain't going nowhere. They were moving in to surround the building he'd gone into, not knowing that he was already out and swinging around behind them. He was sprinting hard, his legs churning rapidly, but he wasn't even slightly out of breath. He burst through the locked back door of another building, terrifying some people huddling inside. Not a sound, he told them. Get upstairs. You're in danger down here. They stared at him wide-eyed and remained motionless. Now! Move! They scrambled down towards the stairs. He moved past them, leading down the halls towards the front of the building. He paused just inside the doorway, listening. He could hear several of them running past him, moving up to surround the building he had run into just before they'd opened fire. He waited until they got into his position, then bolted out of the door, running fast across the street and snapping off three rapid shots as he ran. The two smoke-emitting rounds exploded in the streets just outside the building, and the grenade round went off a fraction of a second later. More screams and more bodies came flying up out of the smoke. Automatic weapons tracked him as he moved across the street, but they failed to take his speed into account, and the bullets missed him, passing behind him as he ran, and he made it to the shelter of a building across the street. He ran through the lobby and into the stairwell. He took the stairs three and four at a time, running up to the top of the building. He could hear the sounds of panicked residents hiding in their rooms as he ran up. Moments later, he was on the roof. He could hear the dragons moving in the streets beneath him, more cautiously this time, closing ranks around the building, trying to hem him in and trap him inside. He ran to the edge of the roof and leaped. Leapt? Don't know why it says leaped. Easily traversing the distance to the next rooftop. He kept right on going, leaping from rooftop to rooftop until he was four buildings away. He holstered the grenade launcher and snapped a thin cable to the fire escape, tested the hold, then clipped it to a small swivel pulley on his harness. Holding onto the cable with one hand, he rappelled down the side of the building, the cable whizzing through the pulley. About 4 seconds later, he was on the ground and moving once again. He unslung the battle rifle and looked down onto the street. He was behind them once again, and the smoke slowly drifting across the street would completely block him from their view. He ran back across the street again, and sprinting from doorway to doorway, he made it to the crumbled ruins where a group of them had first taken up position. He found six bodies lying there, all torn apart by shrapnel. He glanced down at some of the weapons they'd been carrying. Police ordnance, 9mm machine pistols with carbine stocks, and fully automatic assault rifles. He picked up the undamaged ones, bent their barrels, and crushed their receivers, putting them out of commission. He then crouched down behind the ruins of a brick wall and rested his rifle on top of it. The smoke drifting across the street hid them from his view, but he switched in the thermal imagery system, and suddenly their moving figures were visible through the drifting smoke, bright hot spots converging on the building. They were convinced that he was still inside. He smiled and switched the select fire system on his battle rifle to a three-round burst. He squeezed off the first burst, and the figures fell. He aimed again and squeezed off another and another, each one striking dead on target. The dragon scattered and started shouting and firing indiscriminately, still thinking that he was shooting at them from somewhere inside the building. Several of them burst out of the smoke as they came running towards him, and he dropped them in their tracks. Then he started moving once again, switching back to normal vision, as he ran to the next building and went around the side. He slung his battle rifle and unholstered the big 45 from one of his nylon pouches. He took out a sharply prolonged steel dart, shaped roughly like the sort of arrowhead used for hunting deer, but far stronger. He snapped its metal base into the barrel of the big semi-auto, then clipped a nice steel cable to its base. He took aim and fired at the tip of the cornice at the building's roof. The dart flew unerringly to the spot and stuck deeply in the cornice. He tested the line carefully to make sure it would hold his weight, then holstered the 44 and took out a small steel power pulley out of his pouch. It was shaped like a small baton, but about 8 inches long, and not quite 2 inches in diameter, thick at the middle. He clipped the line to it and ran up to the side of the building. He depressed the activating stud, and the power pulley quickly started to wind the cable in, pulling him up the side of the building as he walked his way up the wall. He reached the roof, pulled himself over, unsnapped the cable, and then moved out to the edge where he could see down into the street. The smoke was clearing, and he could see the gang members still milling around, running in all directions and shouting to each other. Most of them had moved quickly out of the center of the street, and a few were running into buildings while others were hugging the walls, thinking he was still inside. They were like sitting ducks. He unslung his battle rifle and aimed down into the street. He switched to full auto and squeezed the trigger, sweeping the length of the building across the way. Puffs of mortar dust and chips of brick erupted where the bullets stuck the wall as he swept its length, taking out five dragons where they stood pressed up against the wall. Pandemonium! Several of them spotted him up on the roof and started to return the fire, but he had already pulled back. He took a running jump and cleared the distance to the next building, kicked in the roof access door, and started running down the stairs. The dragons couldn't understand what was happening. They had thought that they were the only one up against one man, but now it seemed as if there was an entire platoon surrounding them, firing from all directions. As Steel came down the stairs, several of them came running into the lobby, thinking to take shelter from the fire on the rooftop. He came flying down the stairs right into them, knocking them to the ground. He punched one of those he'd landed on and heard the sickening crunch of the bone as the gang member's face disintegrated. Then he was on his feet, grabbing another and throwing him into a wall so hard that his back broke. Another one came up and swung his assault rifle at him. Steel caught it and wrenched it from his grasp, then snapped it like a twig. Steel drove his fist into his chest, smashing his ribcage, and blood spurted from the dragon's mouth as he collapsed to the floor. The last one left brought up his rifle and squeezed off a burst at Steel's chest from point-blank range. The bullet slammed into him, and Steel staggered back several steps, then drew his 44 in a lightning-swift motion and put a slug right between the dragon's eyes. Pausing only long enough to smash their weapons, Steel took a quick glance out the door. His hearing picked up the sounds of a helicopter's blades. He looked up and saw a small news helicopter descending, and two of the dragons on the sidewalk looking up, bringing up their rifles. Steel swore and started running. They heard him coming, and their mouths dropped open in surprise. Then they started to swing their weapons around to bear on him, but they never made it. He plowed into them like a juggernaut, sending them sprawling, drew the 44 and fired twice, both headshots. As the news chopper came down lower, filming the scene, he broke into a run again as the remaining dragons opened fire on him. He felt the bullets striking his chest and legs, but he kept on going, unslinging his rifle as he ran and tracking their fire, then zeroing in and opening up on them with his rifle on full auto. He was running at an angle towards the ruins of a collapsed building across the street, with several large sections of brick wall poking up out of the rubble. Several gang members poked their heads up over the wall, aiming their weapons at him. He leaped into the air and somersaulted, vaulting the wall and coming down behind them. As they turned, he fired, killing them all. The sound of the chopper's blades was overwhelmingly loud in his head, drowning out everything else. He winced and turned down his hearing to normal. There was no more gunfire. He took a quick glance over the wall and saw four gang members running rapidly down the street, away from the scene. He brought up his rifle and shot two of them, and then took off after the third and fourth. They ran inside a building. As he approached the entrance, someone opened up on him from behind. He swung his rifle around, holding it by the pistol grip, and fired a burst on full auto, one-handed, without even looking, shooting in the exact direction of the sound. The firing stopped and the body slumped down into the street from behind a building wall. A child's terrified scream rang out. "Get back, you son of a bitch, or I'll blow her fucking brains out!" The two dragons who had run into the building were coming out through the lobby, one of them holding a small, bedraggled girl up against his chest. She couldn't have been more than 10 years old, and he was using her as a shield, while the other one came up behind him, his assault rifle leveled at Steel. "Back off, motherfucker, or she's dead!" Steel backed up off the sidewalk as they came out. "Put the rifle down, man," said the one holding the terrified girl, his left arm clamped tightly around her neck, choking her. His right hand holding a pistol to her head. "I said put it down! Drop it!" Steel dropped the rifle. "Now back up! Back away from it!" Steel backed up into the middle of the street. The second dragon came out from behind the one holding the hostage, aiming at his rifle right at Steel's head. Steel's eyes suddenly glowed with two bright red pinpoints as he switched to his laser designator. What the fuck? His right arm flashed and the .44 came leaping from its holster. The first shot took the rifleman right in the center of his forehead, hurling him back, the second coming so fast that the other dragon didn't even have time to react. Struck the pistol he was holding on to the girl's head and sent it flying from his grasp. He cried out and released her, clutching at his hand. She fell to the street, gasping and sobbing for air. Steel was on him in an instant. He grabbed him by the throat just beneath the jawbone and lifted him up off the ground one-handed. Careful not to crush his throat, he threw him back against the building wall, and the gang member cried out as he struck and fell to the sidewalk. Steel came walking up to him. Panic-stricken, the young dragon brought out a butterfly knife and snicked it open with a quick flash flick of the wrist. Steel brought the big .45 up and aimed it right between the man's eyes. The gang member stared up at the unwavering muzzle of the big gun and the two glowing pinpoints in Steel's eyes and dropped the knife. Jesus! What the fuck are you, man? Steel holstered the .45 and bent down. 44. I don't know if I've been saying 45. Whatever. Grasping the man by his shoulders and lifting him up, he pressed him back against the wall. The name's Steel, he said, and I got a message for Chang and the rest of your war council. You tell him that as long as the dragons work for Victor Borodini, I'll be coming after them. You can pass the word to the Chingos and all the other gangs. I want Victor Borodini, and anybody who gets in my way is going to get crushed like this. He squeezed. The dragon screamed in agony as the bones in both his shoulders were pulverized. Steel let him go, and he slumped down onto the sidewalk, moaning and whimpering, his arms hanging looselessly at his sides. You be sure to tell him now, said Steel. He turned and walked over to the girl. She was holding her throat and crying. Gently, he picked her up in his arms. There, there now, honey, he said soothingly, switching back to normal vision so the laser designator wouldn't frighten her. It's all right now. No one's going to hurt you anymore. He held her close and stroked her hair as she clutched him around the neck. A woman came running up out of the building, sobbing and calling out the little girl's name. Anna! Anna! It's okay, ma'am, said Steele, handing the girl over to her. It's okay. She wasn't hurt badly. She's going to be all right.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, officer. Thank you.
Take her back inside now, Steele said. As the woman hurried back inside, Steele bent down to pick up his battle rifle. The news chopper descended out into the street.
Officer! Officer!
A woman's voice called out. Officer, over here! Quickly! Steele scowled and shook his head. He ran over to the news chopper before somebody opened up on them. The woman held her hand out and helped him through the hatch as the cameraman behind her continued filming. The chopper lifted up.
That was a damn fool thing to do, he said to her. There might have been more of them. You could have been caught in the ground.
We're paid to take risks, she said. Besides, we couldn't very well just take off and leave you there.
She glanced at the name tag sewn into his chest.
Lieutenant Steele. Linda Tellerman, Eyewitness News.
She held out her hand. He glanced at the camera.
Turn that thing off, he said.
Come on, Steele, you're news, she said. That was an amazing feat of bravery. I've never seen anything like it. One man up against an entire street gang. And that rescue of a little girl? We've got incredible footage. It was...
I said turn it off before I pitch it out at the hatch, said Steele.
Linda Tellerman glanced at the cameraman and nodded. He turned the minicam off and lowered it.
What is it, Steele? She said. You have something against reporters?
Steele looked at her. She was young and pretty in her late 20s or early 30s, with short, neatly styled dark brown hair and brown eyes. She was wearing makeup to look her best on camera, and she had on a tailored one-piece blue nylon flight suit and her station's logo on it. The intrepid young street reporter, out collecting combat pay, covering her beats, trying to look both glamorous and relentlessly professional at the same time.
Miss Tellerman, I don't know you, he said, so I don't have anything personal against you, but I didn't come out here to put on a show for the 6 o'clock news.
Why did you come out here? She asked. We saw your chopper coming in. You went down all alone without any support units. If you ask me, that was a damn fool thing to do. She frowned. Wait a minute. Wasn't there a Lieutenant Steele who was shot in an ambush some months ago in Harlem?
Yeah, that's right.
That was you? But I reported that story, and according to the statement we got from the hospital, you were in a coma with irreversible brain damage.
They managed to patch me up, said Steele.
But how could they possibly?
Linda, said the cameraman. He was staring at Steele. Look at his leg. She glanced down. There were bullet holes in his trousers.
You've been wounded, she said, staring at his leg,
and then she saw the gleam of Nysteel through the rents in the fabric. She reached out to touch his leg. He pulled back.
If you don't mind, miss.
She looked up at him, eyes wide.
Oh, my God, you're the one, she said. Our sources at the federal building leaked the story that they were working on a cyborg. It is you, isn't it?
The corner of Steele's mouth twitched.
I can't believe it, she said. And I've got the first footage of you in action. God, what a scoop.
She picked up her microphone.
Jerry, roll tape.
Steele glanced at the cameraman.
I wouldn't, Jerry.
He switched to laser designator for a second, letting the cameraman see the two glowing pinpoint points of red light in his eyes. Jerry swallowed hard and lowered the minicam again. Anything you say, mister.
Oh, for God's sake, Steele, Linda said, exasperated. Give me a break. This is news. Every reporter in town would kill for this story.
That wouldn't surprise me, Steele said dryly.
Look, just let me ask you a few questions, okay? Just to get the facts straight. The story we've got seemed unbelievable. They said you had a cybernetic brain?
I don't really feel like answering any questions, Miss Tellerman.
You're going to have to answer questions sooner or later. Steele, you can't hide from the press. The people have a right to know. Look, we're not taping. Just tell me if what they say is true.
All right, it's true.
Then you're a machine? A robot?
They tell me I'm a human being, Miss Tellerman. The same as you are. Only I was shot up and they replaced some of my parts with nice steel prosthetics.
But your brain? It's really electronic?
Yeah, my own brain was irreparably damaged, so they gave me a new one, a computer.
That's incredible. I never would have known. How did they do it? How was it programmed?
They used an implant to download all the information from my damaged brain and programmed it into a cybernetic prototype. I still think the same way. I still have the same memories and the same feelings, but they put my personality into a cybernetic brain. I've got blood running through my veins, and I still have this human heart beating in my chest, but my arms and legs are nice steel, and I've got circuitry inside my head. So you tell me if I'm human or not, Miss Tellerman. Frankly, I'm not so sure myself. That ought to give you a nice human interest angle for your story. Is he or isn't he? Only his program knows for sure.
She stared at him.
Did you actually volunteer for this?
I was in a coma, Miss Tellerman. A vegetable. I couldn't very well ask them not to do it.
So you mean you just woke up this way?
That's about the size of it.
She shook her head.
God, how awful for you. I can't imagine how you must have felt.
No, I don't suppose you can.
So you don't feel any different? I mean, aside from your prosthetics, you still think and feel the same way you always did, except that your brain is a computer?
That's about right.
Doesn't that frighten you?
Yeah, frightens me, to be perfectly honest with you, Steele said. How'd you like to wake up one day to find out they'd taken out your brain and programmed your personality into a computer that they'd stuck inside your skull? And how'd you like to have to spend the rest of your life with people looking at you the way you're looking at me now, as if I'm some sort of freak or monster?
She averted her eyes.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean.
Yeah, I know. It's not your fault, said Steele. You can't help it, but you're going to air your story anyway to let the people know about the new cyber cop the police force has, a new government superweapon to aid in the fight against crime. And the next time I come near a little girl like the one back there, she won't throw her arms around my neck like that one did. She'll probably scream and go running home to mother.
The chopper started to descend.
It doesn't have to be that way, Steele, said Linda Tellerman. Not if you tell me your story, explain to the people about who you and what you are. Look, let me put you on camera and interview you so they'll see for themselves what...
No thanks, Miss Tellerman. You tell them anything you like. I couldn't stop you anyway. But I'm not giving any interviews. I don't want to be treated like a freak show.
The helicopter touched down and he stepped out of the hatch.
Steele, wait. He didn't pause to turn around. Steele!
He kept on walking. End of chapter.